What inspires you guys? Is there a particular athlete or coach or source of inspiration that you guys get from for jiu-jitsu?
I'll answer this for you. Bruce Lee and Dragon Ball.
What's the most efficient path to victory against this particular opponent?
He's dropping off the choke here. We could see the finish. It's looking tight. Tight at Delbrun.
Hey guys, welcome to the Everyday Jiu-Jitsu Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Kwan. The Everyday Jiu-Jitsu Podcast is everything you need to know about jiu-jitsu. And today I have two very special guests. I'm a big fan of both of these gentlemen. I have Joseph Chen and Dima Muravani. Dima, Joseph, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Great. So I really appreciate you guys taking time out of your busy schedules to chat with us. Of course, very, very busy right now. I believe you're in Glasgow, Scotland, getting around over there doing seminars. And of course, Joseph just competed in the Polaris 170-pound Grand Prix division. Before we get started on the podcast, again, guys, please, if you can, just like, share, subscribe, leave comments in the bottom. If you want to support the show, there's a link where you could do that. And yeah, we'll just get started. So Dima, I just wanted to get some quick information from you because I'm somewhat familiar with Joseph's background, but I just wanted to get your age, your rank, where you started jiu-jitsu, who you're training under, that type of information.
Yes. So I'm 30 years old and I started jiu-jitsu in the year 2017. I'm under Robert Kras. This is the BJJ Academy in Berlin, and I'm there since day one. So I'm training around about 7 years now, but to be honest, half of the years are on the mat and the other half I was injured. So I think this is why I'm a good coach, because I use the time to still develop my understanding of jiu-jitsu, but outside the mat. And yeah, this is pretty much like the short version of my jiu-jitsu journey so far.
Yeah, you said, I think I heard in a previous podcast, was it an ACL injury you had?
Oh, I had a bunch of injuries, but the first really big injury was actually the ACL with the meniscus, and this came from an electric chair. So please, if you play electric chairs on blue belts, don't pop them, because maybe they don't know what it is. And yeah, but it was my fault. Like, we had a competitive training with probably one of the best guys in Germany, maybe even in Europe at that time. And I wanted to know what I can do. I trained with him quite a bunch and he came back from Athos. So it was a competitive round. And then he got me into an electric chair, and I'm pretty flexible, so I didn't feel anything on the knee. And then after 1 minute in the electric chair, it did pop, 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 pop. And he's like, are you okay? And I'm like, sure, I'm okay. So I continued rolling for, I think, an hour. And then I told to my professor, Robert, yeah, we train tomorrow, like always, because we trained like before the first session, and then we did the session, and then two other sessions later. But I told him that I popped my knee, and he's like, bro, you will not train tomorrow. I'm like, it's fine. So I started jumping on the leg to prove it to him. So he trains with me the next day. And yeah, I couldn't walk after this.
Yeah, I've had bad meniscus issues before. I've had surgery twice on my right knee. I assume you got it. Did you get your meniscus cleaned, or what was the surgery you got done on it?
Yeah, so I tried to do it without the surgery first, because funny thing, the guy that popped my knee got popped with the same move when he was a blue belt, because he didn't know what it was.
Paying it so forward.
He did. Yeah, so it's my duty to do the same to the next generation blue belt. So if you're in my academy and I have you in an electric chair, please don't be mad if I pull it. No, just kidding. So and he didn't get his ACL done. He just did a bunch of training with a guy that is pretty good in it. So I was thinking I will do the same. We're training with the same guy, and actually it worked out. And after 4 or 5 months, I felt fine. And then I do a deep squat and pop, the meniscus tore completely. So then I couldn't move my leg at all. So then I did the surgery. I waited for the surgery for 3 months, because this guy that did the surgery is the best in Germany, and he's like the boss of the knee federation, whatever. So I'm like, okay, good. If he will do the knee, everything will be fine. Yeah. he fucked it up and didn't tell me. So I couldn't walk for one more year and nobody believed me. I did two MRIs. All the doctors told me, bro, your knee is fine. I'm like, I can't move it. And they tell me, do more rehab. I'm like, I'm doing rehab every day. I can't move my leg.
Wait, sorry. When you say you can't move it, do you mean it was locked?
It wasn't locked, but I didn't have the best range of motion. I couldn't walk on the leg. I couldn't put weight into it because it was swollen up immediately. So I had to sit on my couch for almost a year. And then luckily, a friend of mine, Leon, connected me with another guy that is a surgeon. And he also didn't believe me when he saw the pictures. And he didn't believe me because he knew the guy that did the surgery on me. So obviously, they are biased. But he's like, listen, Dima, I will open it for you. So he opens up the knee and there's a really big scar tissue. He takes the scar tissue out and 4 months later I can walk and train again. So, yeah. The universe tries to keep me away from the mat.
So do you have an ACL then?
Yes, now I have an ACL. Like the ACL that he attached to, he did it perfectly. But he injured something in the process. So that's why I had scar tissue in my knee and that's why I couldn't move it. So it took me like 3 years in total until my knee felt good again and 2 years until I could train again. Exactly 2 years. I think in July 2019, it's where I injured my knee. And in July 21 is where I trained again.
Mm-hmm. And pardon this question if it comes off as rude, but I don't even know what rank you are. What belt are you?
Oh, yeah. I'm a brown belt.
Brown belt. So... very interesting. You said something that I say a lot, especially these days. I'm 36, and when I get injured, I find that my priorities shift just because I can't train hard in those times. And it's been happening lately. You know, as you get older, injuries start to add up. Old injuries start to have more effect, and it really allows me as a gym owner and a coach to kind of prioritize my students more and really work on myself as a coach. So you think that as you know, in that year and a bit time with your knee injury, that's what really allowed you to focus on coaching. And that now you believe that that has given you the time and the focus to become the coach that you are today.
Yes. So like actually my whole focus as a coach only started, I think when we did the camp in Jason Rouse Academy, and this was only 1 or 2 months before the trials that Joseph won. But before that, when I was injured, I had no other choice but to be more or less of a coach, because I could sit there and I could talk with people, I could help them with the knowledge that I acquired, but I couldn't really test it out. So yeah, it definitely helps with the coaching. And if you look at the greatest coaches in jiu-jitsu, because there's no money in jiu-jitsu, you will not see people from the outside coming in that were like, let's say, good athletes, but not the best athletes, but they have a good mind. They will not come into the sport and pursue coaching because there's no money in it. If they're intelligent people, they will probably do something else. So what you see in jiu-jitsu is the people that get injured, but really love jiu-jitsu and don't want to like train less or not spend time on the matter. They will still pursue it, be a good coach, and spend their time by watching tape or sitting with the students or trying stuff out what they can. So if your legs are fucked, maybe you can still work on front headlocks. Maybe you can look how you can apply pressure in the turtle. And I think if you look at the coaches in jiu-jitsu, like John Danaher, Greg Sanders is his name, right?
Greg Saunders.
Yeah, I think what we all have in common, not that I'm as great as them, but I'm also a coach. I'm obviously not as great as them, but we have the same history. So we were injured, and I think if we wouldn't be injured, we will probably try to be good athletes. But I think you need to do what you can do. And if you can't train yourself because of injuries, this is life. Do the best that you can, and you can still get technically better. I feel like every time I go back to the mats, even if I don't have the mat time, I get technically better. My reaction time is just not as great, but this comes back with a couple of training sessions. So, yeah, I definitely think it helped a lot.
Have you competed before, and do you have aspirations of competing one day, or are you just focusing on coaching now?
Yeah, I competed quite a bunch. So my goal was to win something in Europe when I started, because I started with 24 years, And I competed pretty much every month after the third month of my jiu-jitsu training. And as white belt, I didn't win anything. I think I got second so many times. And then as blue belt, it clicked. So I received my blue belt, and this actually where I started being, or like in the end of white belt, I started actually to have competitive rounds with some black belts, obviously not the best black belts in the world, gym black belts. And then I won all my blue belt tournaments except of two, where I placed second. And I also competed in tournaments against higher ranked people. So especially Nogi, I did a couple of tournaments where I competed like against all the belts, and I still won them. And yeah, in 2019, when I got injured, after that, I didn't compete it at all because I obviously couldn't train. And every time I tried to compete again, because this was my goal, I want to compete. I trained, and then I got other injuries. And this happened 3 or 4 times, like random injuries. One of the injuries is a hernia that I achieved by eating 4 meals in a row. So not even jiu-jitsu related. And then I was like, I think I want to do 3 competitions, and every time I wanted to do it, something happened right before the competition. So I had an opportunity to compete in not New York, but close to New York. And I was like, fuck it, I will do it. And I only had 3 weeks of training because I was out for 5 months because of a hand injury. So I took the match. I felt shitty. The other guy was good. Like, not that he only won because I felt shit, but I didn't felt great. And if you look at the match, like, that's where I realized, okay, if I can't train properly, I maybe shouldn't pursue being an athlete. And if one day I can really train again, like I want my athletes to train, then I will probably also compete. It's like, I love to compete. I don't love to compete, but I love to get out there and having the feeling after a couple competitions to actually feel good in there and show what I can in training. But this takes a couple of competitions before I feel this way. So yeah, to come to your question, I hope I can compete one day, but right now I concentrate on being a coach.
So you said something interesting, and Joseph, you could chime in here too. And as a competitor myself, I've been competing for over 10 years myself. You said, I love competing. Well, actually, I don't love competing. But, and then we have a reason why we compete. I mean, I compete because, I used to compete because I just felt natural at it. But now at the black belt levels, and as I get older, it's fucking hard, man, to hang out with guys. Like, you know, I did the East Coast trials last, and the level's so high. It's fucking crazy. I don't really know why I compete anymore other than just to, I guess, test myself and to market my, academy and my, whatever brand. Why do you guys compete? Do you enjoy competing? Joseph, I know you've mentioned in the past that you don't really want to spend that many years competing. Why do you compete? Do you enjoy it?
Yeah, so I'll answer this then. I mean, I definitely think there's different people. At this point, I think everyone has some degree of anxiety and fear when competing, but I've definitely met people who some people are more comfortable and less comfortable competing. In terms of the reason to compete, I feel similarly, where it's like more about being able to put yourself out there to make a living, and then like secondary to that, it's like trying to see what you're capable of, because I feel like at least for me, I train to just train. I don't, there's no, like, my training isn't necessarily motivated by my will to compete and be competitive. It's because I want to train and I enjoy the process of training and improving in this regard. And then I view competition as one, a means to be able to make a living, but also like a test. So to see, okay, what have I been working on and how is that holding up under like competition, like scenarios.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Dima, why do you want to compete? Why would you? Why is it something that you want to do? Yeah. Just to test yourself? Or I know you've mentioned in a recent podcast that opening an academy is a goal for you one day. And would that just be something that would be used as kind of like a marketing tool?
Yeah. So in the end, we all want to live out of what we love, so we need to make somehow money with academies, seminars, and other stuff. But for me, competing, like, I wanted to be a good competitor, but the first competitions were miserable. Like, I felt miserable, and I feel so nervous. It's actually crazy how nervous I feel. And I think a lot of people feel the same way. So I didn't enjoy it in the beginning. But do 20 competitions, and after that, it becomes normal. And then the fun part begins, in my opinion, for me at least, to actually test myself against people of my skill or higher skill. Like, I think there's nothing more fun than to go out there and people think, oh, you can't beat this guy, and this guy is one of the best. And you go in there, show your techniques, and you are just free. So you enter the flow state. And I think these times where I entered the flow state in competition were probably not the best times of my life, but one of the best times of my life. So if you feel flowy, if you don't think about anything anymore and you enter the state, nothing matters anymore. No nerves, no winning, no losing. It's just you expressing yourself. And I really like this. You can achieve this in training, but in competition it's just a different thing. So I hope that I can do it again one day and feel like this.
It's fascinating because the three of us all have competition aspirations. I assume gym owning, academy aspirations, making a living off of jiu-jitsu, right? We all have that in common, but it sounds like none of us really had ever been motivated to compete with the goal of, I want this title, or my dream is to become a world champion. This, it's something that I've never really had. When I started jiu-jitsu, like, there were very few black belts in Vancouver. Now there's quite a few, and quite a few questionable ones at that. But my goal to compete, it was never, oh, I'm going to be a world champ one day. That's the end goal. It was, I just don't want to have a job. I want my job to be to share jiu-jitsu and to do jiu-jitsu and just make my passion. Right. Like, that's really the ultimate freedom. Right. And I think that more and more people should aspire to follow what they love to do rather than, you know, spend 8 hours at a desk or filing papers or whatever. So I totally resonate with you guys there. I got to ask you this, you know, you're a brown belt, and, you know, all of a sudden I hear of this guy, Dima, he's this world-class coach. I just came out of nowhere and I was like, I've never heard of this guy. Let me ask you, like, what are you doing differently that makes you a high level coach and makes high level athletes, like, you have a stable of high level athletes that kind of work with you. What are you doing differently that makes you, such an effective coach?
Yeah. So I think the coaching is in my blood since I'm a kid. I can't tell you why. I think it's, I would say, kind of a talent, because all of my friends that I know, my best friends, like my community, we met somehow by me coaching them. For example, my best friend, Max, like, I know him since the fifth grade. And if I remember correctly how we met, I think there was a guy, his name is Werner, and he was like the bully of the school, okay? And everybody was afraid of him. So he also was afraid of him a little bit. That's why he became his friend, to chill with him. So normal school stuff, right? You don't want to get bullied, so you chill with the bully. And then one day he sees me talking to him, and Werner just says something about me. And I'm like, are you sure? And then he's like, yeah. So I just come up, beat him up, and go back. And he was so fascinated by it. So he came to me, he's like, how can I do this? And I'm like, I will coach you how to do it. And then actually he did it on him, didn't get bullied again. And this is how our friendship starts. So I have stories like this all over again. So I think this plays a part in it. And I, yeah, funny, right? And I'm obsessed with jiu-jitsu. So I'm really obsessed with it, because it feels like if I'm not doing something that I love, and I think jiu-jitsu is, I don't know why, but it is the way it is. It's something where I can actually concentrate on. And if I don't have this, I feel miserable. So I spend almost the whole day doing jiu-jitsu, except of now, because I spent so much hours doing jiu-jitsu in the past months, especially watching tape for this guy. So now I'm not watching tape. I try to chill and he watches tape again. So it's still tape in the house. And yeah. And I have my own philosophy. And I think the biggest, like, one or two of the biggest parts are that I'm open-minded. I don't think that I know everything. So even if I coach people and they show me something that is better than what I do, I will steal it immediately. And this happens almost every day. And I think being open-minded is something that I got from my coach, Robert. I came as a white belt with techniques to him, with John Danaher techniques, before he even had an instructional out. And he was listening to me as a black belt, to a random white belt that did anything in his life in jiu-jitsu. And he listened to me and we worked together on it. So he's a big part of it. And I'm the same. So even when I get my black belt, I will have a white belt mindset of listening to everything and taking what works. So we shouldn't be blinded by anything. What works, we should try it out and take it.
Mm-hmm. I definitely agree with that too. Like I'd like to think as a coach, I have an open mind too. Like it won't be random or rare that I even have like blue belts in my school come up and question me, or they're watching instructionals and they're like, hey, I saw, you know, Gordon show this. What do you think of this? And it's like, that puts something that I've done for years in a different context. And now I look at that move differently or that situation differently. And I think that if you have that open mind and if you're, you know, like you said, obsessed with jiu-jitsu, that's like such a good, those are really good ingredients for an environment that really fosters development and just where everyone can get better, right? I have been in those environments where instructors kind of think that they know everything, or they think, no, I found the best way. And that's a pretty good way to sort of shut down free thought. And I think that is, that will stifle growth. Just as a side question real quick, did you get into a lot of fights growing up? Was that like a thing?
Me?
Yeah. Did you say you fought that guy and...
No, that was more like he's like, oh, I'm the best, and I'm just putting him down and like, shut up, and then I go back. But
you slapped him or punched him?
No, I grabbed him and punched him down. But nothing serious. I don't know. I just believed in it.
And you weren't even trained at the time. You were just sending it.
No.
He just saw red.
No, to be honest, I trained since I was 6 in Taekwondo and kickboxing until 12, 13, I think. So this is where we met. So I had previous martial arts. I trained previously martial arts, but I just believed in me. So you need to know something about me. I believe in a lot of things that I say, even if I don't know them. So he hates me for this. Like, for example, if we go a direction, I just go into this direction with the highest belief that it's the right direction and it's the wrong direction. So people just following me and then we are lost. So sometimes I believe a little bit too much in me, but yeah. Sorry, what was the question?
I just asked you if you got into fights growing up because you sounded like you whooped that dude's ass.
No. I only got into 3 fights that were real fights. And after the last one, I never fought again because this was in a place in Leipzig. And one random guy, we were 14, so this was the last time. And there was a 20-year-old. He was really large and he was screaming at my friend, making jokes of him. And my friend said something back. Max, by the way, same friend. And then he was launching into us and I push kicked him and he was falling back. And then out of the blue, 6-7 guys come out and they all punch into me. So from the one side, you see all of them punching into me and my friends are shocked. And from the other side, one of my friends, Felix, is running into me and he sees me slipping and walking back. Again, this is no technique. I was just believing in it and somehow it worked. Like, don't do this. You will get killed. Like, I was just really lucky. And then the last sequence was I kicked the guy in the ribs. I heard pops and my friend headbutts him. He falls. And then another guy pepper sprays his eyes, so of my friend. And then they took the guy and they were fleeing. So I had to bring my friend into the hospital. And this was the last time we fought. And this is the day where Lena Meyer Landrut won the Eurovision Song Contest. That's why I remember the day so well. So never get into fights. It's stupid. We could have died. I heard that one guy had the knife. So it was just stupid. And the next time if someone makes fun of me, I will say, bro, you're right. I need a hair transplant, whatever they say. Please sponsor me. I didn't fought too much.
What do you guys' practices look like? And Joseph, just being like who you are as a, you know, one of the household names right now, one of the hottest young competitors, and being, you know, I'm just watching Engaging Without Regrets right now. I really like your instruction. Just being who you are, do you contribute to the practices just as much as Dima? Is it like a joint thing? Is it everyone around the room is collaborating, or is Dima kind of leading the charge? How do you break down what practices look like? Let's say it's an hour and a half or 2 hours, like kind of by the 10-minute mark. I'm just curious the framework and your philosophies of training.
Yeah, so I think Dima has a lot more authority when it's leading up to a competition, because that's when I think, let's say, a lot of the direction will come from him. But like, for example, now there's no one here or in our training sessions it really needs to compete. So it's a lot more laissez-faire in our approach. So it really goes back and forth between people. So like, for example, today we basically just... we were practicing techniques that were specific to us. So like, for example, I was practicing arm triangles. And then what were you practicing with Cameron? You're practicing like...
The stuff that you showed with the half butterfly.
Yeah, dealing with half butterfly from top. And it's kind of like everyone's just workshopping together. It's not necessarily structured as a specific class. But then once again, this train... Like, I think one of my earliest memories when meeting with Dima was we discussed this idea of distinguishing between growth and performance. And this is really how the training is structured. So when it's really performance oriented and we're really practicing to be able to work under pressure, that's when really Dima takes the reins there. But then outside of that, there's a lot of self-direction, at least in the regards of structuring a training. So like, we don't necessarily have a fixed schedule, because also we don't, because we're traveling and everything. And even when I'm at home, like even when I'm at home in Shanghai, when I structure the training, we have like 2 or 3 hours of just, I wouldn't say it's an open mat, but it's like time to workshop. So like the people who do jiu-jitsu like more frequently, like who take it more seriously, they'll come in like 3 hours before class and we'll drill, we'll practice, we'll do specific rounds based on what everyone's needs are. So it's not very fixed. And then there'll be a class afterwards, and then the class is more structured. But that's less training. That's a class.
Okay, so let's say let's talk about the structure class then, right? Like, I assume we're not doing, you know, a warm-up. I assume you're doing a lot of, like, task-focused games or live training versus resistance. I guess my question is, how much of it at the end is free rolling? How much of it is explicit instruction? Do you believe in explicit instruction or showing techniques? Like, can you sort of give me a clue as to how the class portion would be structured?
Yeah, so I mean, I think, I don't know, maybe he has a different, because I don't necessarily teach classes where he is, so we might have different ideas with this, but at least, for example, the way I structure classes, like generally you fit into like an hour or an hour and a half time frame. And so I'm still of the idea that I like showing technique per se, but I like to show technique in a way where it's I'm presenting a solution to a problem. And so I'll try to like set up like the setting or the context in which we're doing this. And then I'll show like a few different ideas and try to explain the rationale between a certain decision. So let's say the technique takes up like 45 minutes to an hour or something like this. And I try to encourage within that period of time, a lot of discussion, just so it's, I really don't like drilling for reps. I know that there can be an argument made for why one should, but generally for me and the way I like to train myself, I really don't do anything of the sorts. I would like to really play around with certain positions and create this dialogue with a training partner where I ask them, what are you going to do from here? How, like, if I'm working a strangle, I'm like, okay, where do you think I should go from here if it's not working? And so on and so on and so on. And so after that, if I'm running the class, I'll put a few like position rounds, or like, I stole this from Bernacki, right? Like the fuck your jiu-jitsu rounds. Initially, this is my initial inspiration from this, where based on the problem of the class or like whatever context was set up, and usually maybe it can come in stages. So like, for example, I'll just use like a tripod. entering the tripod and maintaining a tripod. This could be the focus of the class. And so we'll do rounds from entering the tripod and then maintaining the tripod. And they're two separate things. Similar, actually, my initial idea for this framework, this is like from the application of a passing person, but was from when you and Steve talked about it on mental models, when you talked about phases of engagement, and it was from bottom position. It was like the engagement phase, the maintenance phase, and the offense phase. And it's the same framework that I try to follow from teaching on top and bottom and all of this. And then we'll do specific games or rounds where, okay, we have a specific goal and we really try to limit things. So for example, if it's a maintenance round, I just try make it so that, okay, you're going to hold the tripod, but you're not going to try pass from there. You're just going to try hold this against resistance. And then do that a few times, and then I'll give time in between the rounds for people to discuss, and we'll do a few of those, and then we go into open rounds.
Nice. So,
I mean, long answer. Hopefully that makes some sense.
It's very similar to sort of what I do. Like, we're all, I think, past the point of warm-ups that are kind of irrelevant to the actual skill development of jiu-jitsu, right?
To be fair, there is some application for warm-ups. Like, if there's a white belt class, I don't really teach beginners, so I don't use do warm-ups. I think there's an argument to be made to, like, okay, for beginners, like, if you don't know how to do a front roll, I think it's quite important, especially if you're going to teach something that requires a similar movement. But because I don't teach beginners classes, I generally don't teach warm-ups.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to try and sound as much like Greg Sauders as I can with this next question. Can affordance perception be direct and indirect at the same time? Do you want me to elaborate what that means?
Can you say it again?
Okay. Affordance perception. So basically the ability to sense an opponent's next move. So can that be influenced both directly and indirectly? So direct training would be like task focused games, live resistance. You know, Greg Sauders, he's all about everything has to be somewhat live to develop skill. Indirect would mean like, let's say, explicit instruction. So I show a move, we're going to try to do the move, then we go from there, whether we go live or whether we just roll, okay? I find the balance, just with my experience teaching kids, beginners, people of all levels, my gym's almost been open for 10 years now. I find there's a balance somewhere in the middle. For example, if I'm going to teach a technique, if you believe in techniques, right? Like the eco guys think there's no such, or they say there's no such thing as a technique because it's always infinite.
I also believe in technique.
There's infinite variables, right? Yes, it's a little bit of hyperbolic language going on that kind of makes it more edgy and makes you want to talk about it, right? Like anyone who listens to this fucking show knows that I talk about it all the time. I've had Greg on the show multiple times. I love talking to the guy. But my question is, as coaches, as high level thinkers in the sport, do you guys think that somebody's ability to improve essentially can be both direct and indirect at the same time? Or is it behavior is only influenced by one or the other?
I think both. I agree with both. So if we come back to the last question, just so I can also say how I do the skill development and the performance training. So when we do performance, for example, with high-level athletes, it's difficult to structure because you have different personalities with different skill sets. So you need to be more on hand with everybody. So you need to do this thing with them and this thing with them. But if you have a classroom that you develop from the beginning, I think both indirect and direct is the way to go because you don't know how good they will respond to one or the other. So give them both so they can find themselves and then they can develop their own thinking how they should train. But what I like to do in the training, so I categorize it not by techniques, but I will still show techniques to support the idea. For example, the idea of being comfortable in entanglements. of balancing from entanglements, holding someone down, standing up, not getting entangled, trying to entangle, bring someone down, and stuff like this. So this is basically all that I teach. But you need to present techniques, in my opinion, for people to understand it. For example, if I show you an elbow pass, okay? So I have Joseph with a collar tie. He wants to disengage, push me away with this hand. And I just do an elbow pass, okay? This is a very simple technique. And I can condition you to do this every time the hand comes. You can do it only by drilling. You don't need to go live for it. And this is what wrestlers also do. So you need to categorize it in different areas. If you go more to jiu-jitsu techniques, okay, I understand that you want to go more live. But jiu-jitsu is not only about the ground anymore. It's also how to get to the ground, how to get up the ground, and in between. So both is probably the best, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. I believe that if a technique is new or something you've never done before, the best way to do it is to try it against non-resisting opponent or an uke who's not really resisting. but then obviously to develop the skill of that technique, you need to start now putting it into live situations so that we can develop a system, right? We can develop a framework. How are we going to get there? What are the common problems that are going to arise when we get there? What are the common, if we need to bail out of this to a new situation, what are those avenues? Like, I think that's kind of how systems are developed, if that makes sense. Whereas I think a lot of the eco training is, let's go into a situation and not tell people the answer, but sort of encourage them to find it themselves by framing the question a particular way. But again, I think people who are just doing eco, you know, I think their conditioning is going to be fantastic. And I think in live situations, they're going to be fantastic. But I also think that it is possible to influence behavior just by showing someone something. And I think you guys have probably felt this too, like, especially when maybe not at the beginner level, but when you're at a certain level, you know, if I watch Joseph Chan show an engagement battle on his DVD that I've never seen before, and I'm like, oh, that's great. Like, I never even thought of that. Like, one was if the guy gets a 2-on-1 from the bottom and you literally just create Kazushi and he has to now post. I was like, okay, I can do that today without trying it. I can, like, it's good to practice it, but I know that I'll be able to, like, do something like that right away. I can use it right away. So how can we say that, explicit instruction wouldn't or couldn't influence behavior? I think that it absolutely can. But people who are just doing moves, you know, and just doing drills for reps, like, they're also missing the plot as well. They're also kind of leaving a lot of potential growth on the table. So I definitely think there's somewhere in the middle. And I don't think anyone would disagree that live training is absolutely necessary. If you're not doing these, whatever you want to call it, fuck your jiu-jitsu or task focused games, whatever you want to call it, like, you're that should be part of everyone's training schedule. Now, even before Bernacki was talking about it, I remember hearing Kit Dale talk about these task focused games. Never drill again, right? Drilling is a waste of time. But I mean, mm-hmm. I personally think drilling is actually very important just for movement and for to train when you're not exhausting your body, you know, if you're injured. Like, there's a lot of good applications for drilling, I would say.
Yeah, I definitely think a lot of this, extremism is more of, like, for marketing, because I think there is a lot of nuances in between. Because obviously, I think if you're too extreme in one direction, it's generally not the greatest sign. I think you can really push it to try to see how far you can take something, but like, for me, I definitely don't lean too much either way, because I think, like, drilling, and I do think there are definitely right ways to drill and wrong ways to drill. And the same thing, like, in terms of positional rounds or, like, what you call task-based games, there's right ways to approach it and wrong ways to approach it. Like, I think really having what is the desired outcome in mind is very important. Like, similar with drilling, let's say if I want to troubleshoot my leg drag position, I'm not just going to drill 100 leg drag entries and finishes, right? It's like, what's the purpose of what I'm trying to do? Similarly with, let's say I'm doing a mount positional round, but I'm doing this for the purpose of trying to get better at submitting from mount. I'm not just going to do mount rounds and then, okay, we're just going to go from here until something happens and whatever can happen. I'm going to try narrow it down to, okay, what am I trying to do? And then try to first figure out, okay, how can I get to a certain type of upper body configuration so I can transition to an attack, or I can start from a certain upper body configuration and so on and so on. It's not just like, I'm just doing this because I want to do this, you know?
Absolutely. Can we talk about Polaris for a minute? The tournament that you just did, right? So you fought Harrison. Harrison's one of my students. The guy's very fucking strong, and he's been doing leg locks now for like you felt that, right? He's been doing leg locks now for about a year and a half, right? Sorry, say that again. Okay. I couldn't hear you.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was like, when he mercy gripped me, I was like, oh shit.
Yeah, like I'm shocked he can do 170. I don't think he's going to be able to make 170 very much longer, just because he is, you know, you guys are both young. Like, you're not even 20, right? You're 19.
Yeah, still 19.
Yeah, so like you're still going to grow in. You're still going to keep developing. And this guy, like, I don't think he's going to be able to make 170 for very much longer. He came to my gym as already a very high level purple belt with very little leg game. And now all of a sudden, you know, he's really developed, or you almost heel hooked him. That highlight is kind of making waves where you reversed him from 50-50. I even told him, I said, you know, you go against these good guys who are very comfortable in the leg entanglements. I just don't see 50-50 being kind of an optimal position to attack from, because it's, I feel very safe in the 50-50, even going with him. He really loves 50-50, but these high level guys, they have an opportunity to counter you from that position. Whereas if you pick a leg entanglement that's a little bit more asymmetrical, you know, it'll be harder for them to counter you. And then of course, anyone who watched the match, you know, there was a couple crucial mistakes he made. I think one of the other mistakes he made was when he attacked that outside heel hook. I think he was getting frustrated and he was kind of getting tired of being in the defensive cycle. And he was really just trying to force that outside Ashi to work. And as you were coming around to the back, of course, he didn't have an Achilles grip. He was trying to force a heel hook that just wasn't there. And you were able to take the back in a very slick way. There was also a time in the match where you were attacking his leg and he came up on top and tried to create back exposure, and you bailed out right at the right time and were able to Granby back into a guard and recover, which I thought was really excellent. So there's really nice high level exchanges there. I'm just talking about Harrison right now. I don't really have a question about him. My real question is, let's say you were to fight Levi Leary Jones again, would you adjust your strategy? Like, what, going into that match, if you could do it again, knowing what you know now that you fought him, what would you adjust? What would you change?
I mean, the purpose of Polaris is more to display a lot of the stuff I've been working on. So obviously no one wants to go in there and lose, but there are things that I probably could have done to make it so that it would have been easier to win. But that wasn't necessarily the primary focus, because especially I probably haven't competed in, like, I don't know, like 6 months at this
point. More than half a year.
Yeah. Like 6 months at this point. So there's a lot of things that I wanted to try out, and I really wanted to see how, like, some of my passing stuff would stack up against some, like, Levi's guard. There's an argument to be made that, like, maybe after, like, towards the end of the match, I should have just, like, fucking bailed on the passing and then maybe tried switching up the game plan completely. But the goal was to try to pass him and work in that type of manner. So depending, we could shift, our goal to just focus on the win, and then I could have tried playing more strategically. Like, obviously the back take, I think on his part, was very good. Like, there are things that I could have done to try maybe avoid engagement as much. But in regards to changing the game plan and, like, still focus, I'm not focusing on passing, I probably would have just stuck with that for the purpose of what the tournament was. I mean, Dima also helped me a lot. I mean, he also can probably speak on this.
Yeah. So, in regards of the match, I think the strategy was even fine for Polaris. Like, we want to display the skills that we were working on for ADCC. Most important thing is ADCC. 20K is pretty nice, but it's nicer to win the world championship. So if you're not going into the competition and display the skills that you were working on, you're missing an opportunity to fix your own competition game. You can see a bunch of guys having one game at the competition, and then they do new stuff at their training, but they're not using it in competition because they didn't use it before. Okay, it's a different setting, so you need to be comfortable in doing this. And yeah, don't underestimate Levi. The backtake was pretty slick, right? If there wouldn't be a backtake, if Joseph would defend the backtake or would be more cautious, I think the strategy would still be good because he was on the attack the whole time. So even if he would drop back for a leg lock, like, you play into Levi's calves because he trains leg locks probably every day since the last month. So I wouldn't underestimate him there. And his bolos are strong. I think the best way to win against him is not getting engaged, pass to the outside, and eventually break through. And I think if Joseph would have a couple more minutes, maybe he could break through. We don't know it, but yeah, I'm still proud of his performance. Only thing I didn't like is that he engaged a little bit too quick into the takedown stuff. Like, I think he could get a point there, but yeah, fair play to Levi. He did a beautiful job of getting the bag.
Does losing make you better?
Probably. I don't think it makes too much of
probably. Yeah, I mean,
it's meaningless.
There's that old saying, right? You either, what is it? You win or you learn, right? And then there's lots of guys that say, well, why can't we do both? Why can't we win and learn? And I guess that is true. However, I can think of many times when I've lost where I've come out in the long run gaining things. And I think losing itself doesn't make you better. It kind of has to do with your mindset and your ability to adapt and to sort of question what you're doing that actually makes you better. But I think losing can provide opportunities to get better.
For sure. I mean, similarly with winning, like you said, I really think the mindset really is what determines what you take from it. For me, at least, I think winning or losing, it really, as long as I'm not injured, it really doesn't feel too different. Obviously, it's nice to win, but the day after, it doesn't really affect. Like, when I won trials, it was, like, sick, nice. I'm relieved more than I am happy. But the same thing with every competition, to be honest.
What I would like to see from all of my athletes, and I think especially with Linus, he's, like, the guy that I built up in the Snogi journey from the beginning. And we needed to fix this before he will win the bigger tournaments. And I believe he can and will probably do it in the future. We needed to fix this mindset in regards of winning and losing. What I like to see from my athletes is when you win, it's indifferent. When you lose, it's indifferent. You should still be happy the next day and try to improve. So if you can achieve that, I think you can have a beautiful life in the sport. It's maybe not the best if you want to be the greatest of all time. Maybe you should switch the mindset there. But even if you want to be the greatest of all time, I think you can achieve this with this, because there are plenty of examples that have been indifferent and just like what they do, and they've gone pretty far in martial arts.
We should just get super toxic, and then maybe we'll win more.
Maybe.
Just get, like, super Chad in the training room and just toxic masculinity, or?
Everything, you know?
all the toxicity.
I'm going to start teaching fake techniques so I win more.
Nice. Joseph, do you have a lot of injuries at all, or do you ever get injured, or are you still just 19 and full of growth hormone naturally?
Man, I definitely think I'm not as bad as a lot. Definitely not as bad as this old man, but.
Hey, I'm fucking older than him.
Okay. I'm backfired then. No. Minor injuries like fingers and stuff. I know you have a gnarly finger. I've seen one video of you. Like, I have a bit of like this, but nothing too serious. Minor like things here and there. I hurt, injured. Like, I've never seriously injured my knees, but you know, you get a few tweaks and tears and stuff like this. Like, I think actually, Mateus injured me. So the ankle, that was probably one of my more severe injuries, but that one, it's okay nowadays. I did injure myself playing spike ball, That was also an injury. I injured my knee, but other than that, nothing too serious yet, and hopefully it stays that way.
What is good corner advice for an athlete during a match? Like, I tend to...
Don't get passed!
Poha.
Don't get passed!
Don't get passed. There's so many fucking... like, on the local level, on the local level, you? It's fucking crazy the things that I hear coaches say, man. Like, it's really fucking bad. I have a whole episode on, you know, tips that I think to be a better corner, but I'm curious, like, I've heard Danaher talk about being a corner, and he says, basically, I don't say much because as a coach, my role has been practically fulfilled by the time it's fight day. Like, there's not much I can say. You might not even fucking hear me, depending on how loud it is. But you'll remember my voice, right? You'll remember me during the sessions, trying to walk you through problem solving and whatnot. So, like, on any given fight day, I guess this question's more directed at Dima. Like, what's some of the advice that you would give to an athlete, or what is some advice that you would give to a coach to be a better cornerman?
Yes. Don't use language that you didn't use in training. So if you call something to your athlete, you should have called it to him in training minimum 10 times so he knows what it is. Because if your athlete needs to think about what you said and your athlete is listening to you, you just disturb his reaction time. Okay? So I repeat myself often, and I mostly use 4 or 5 words, and I repeat this because we did this in preparation. So the athlete knows what I mean by this. And this is basically it. I also agree most of the coaching should be in training, but still we need to communicate, and it should be, you shouldn't even think about it. The body should do everything on its own when they listen to the words. And this is only achieved by repeating this in training. Maybe Joseph can even give a better answer because he can actually say what helps that I call and what doesn't help.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, it's usually just making sure I don't get tunnel visioned. I think this is something that's, what's it called? You can get quite a bit, especially in the heat of competition. You're focused on one goal, and especially if you've practiced so many different ways to deal with a problem in training, it's just a matter of realizing when to change it up a little bit. So like, let's say a certain type of pass isn't working, and just prompting the athlete to see, oh, that you have this available, and then opening your eyes up to that and so on. And then if that works, you have that as an option. I think there have been quite a few examples of this being very helpful for me.
Here's another question. Is it possible for somebody who performs poorly on the mats to be a very effective coach?
You suck, so yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I don't suck. He fucks me up, though, I have to admit this. Like, yeah. Like, for example, we have a good room, like, with good people, really good people. I do great with all of them. I roll with him, and I feel like a white belt. Like, I see what he's doing, and I know what I need to do, but his arm is already there, and I'm like, okay, I guess I get outside he look now. But then, after the training, I can still show him something that he can do well, but in training, yeah, it's probably better to show him something before he fucks me up. But yeah, so, I think it's to your question, what do you mean by poorly? So let's say you have a 30-year-old that has an arm injury and he goes against a 33-year-old with an arm injury. Are you still performing poorly against this guy if you guys have the same training experience, if you guys were the same time injured? Then I think this is questionable, right? But in your own spectrum, you should do well on the mats. Obviously, as a 30-year-old that started with 24 and is injured half of the time, you will not compete well on the mats against a 19-year-old that won trials. You need to understand this. This is reality. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that you can't help them out. Like, I don't think that any of the football or, for the American, US soccer coaches could beat anyone in their team in football. They couldn't score a goal against the best keepers, right? But they are the better coaches. They are the better trainers. So these are different things. You need to have the knowledge. You need to understand how to perform it. You need to perform it in your own spectrum, if you can. If you have both legs broken, obviously, you can only perform it to a certain extent in your spectrum. And you need to understand how to help the people. Like, even if Joseph can win worlds and I can't win worlds, maybe I can help 3 people win worlds and he can only help 1. Maybe. That's not the case, but this is how I see this conversation.
The way that I word the question was a little bit open-ended. Perform poorly, I think, like you said, you know, let's keep it realistic. Let's keep it on a spectrum. I think that that's something that I was keeping in mind when I asked it, but I didn't phrase it that way. I didn't mean like someone who's absolutely garbage. I mean like someone who's good, but, you know, like you said, when you go with Joseph, like he fucks you up. So he fucks you up, but yet you coach him. But you can help bring the best out of him and Joseph, even if you roll with him and you're like, hey, I can kind of do what I want with him. You still think, you know, he's a very effective coach.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are certain reasons why one may or may not be effective. So like we talked about this idea again, growth versus performance, and how I think they're very contrasting. So a lot of the skills that are necessary for performance are going to be harder for someone who can't train very frequently to develop. Like a lot of the timing, a lot of like your proprioception and stuff like this is going to be a lot harder just if you're not spending the same amount of time in the position. If you have to think of everything consciously and you have to be actively thinking about everything as opposed to reacting intuitively, a lot of these things are going to be harder to do. And so this is where one may struggle a lot more. But like, for example, right before before me and Dima had a round, he was helping me with my strangle finishes from an arm triangle, and I just couldn't do it, but he could. And so it's not saying that there's necessarily there's always a gap in technique. It's not necessarily technique or skill, but it's also the skills associated with performing well.
What inspires you guys? Is there a particular athlete or coach or source of inspiration that you guys get for jiu-jitsu?
I'll answer this for you. Bruce Lee and Dragon Ball. I'm right.
He's about right. I can go more in depth, like in the grappling aspect, like for example, John Smith, Zed Alive. There are a bunch of people, but yeah, he's right. Dragon Ball and Bruce Lee. Like these are the, without them, I probably wouldn't do all of this.
I've heard you talk a lot about instructionals, Joseph, and you've put out instructional. Do you have a favorite one or one that has helped you? It stood out to you as one of the most valuable ones that you've ever come across.
Most valuable one. I've talked about underrated instructionals, but I haven't thought of the problem of the most valuable one. Let me think actually.
But the things, wouldn't you say that Rob Bernanke, like,
oh, don't say that. He's going to fucking, it'll pump him up. Don't say Bernanke. No, I'm just kidding. That's my coach for those who don't know.
He provides a good foundation, but I think.
He was one of the guys, him and Ryan Hall, they were like one of the guys who was first really trying to get people to buy into like conceptual jiu-jitsu as opposed to just making an instructional with like, here's 20 techniques, you know. It was more about the concepts and the underlying principles behind jiu-jitsu. Why does jiu-jitsu work? What will make something work? So absolutely, like there's a reason why Rob's my coach. One of them is because he has brutal feedback and I needed to hear it at the right times, but the way that he approaches jiu-jitsu and teaches jiu-jitsu, I do think Bernanke is exceptional.
I think the only reason I like his teaching is because he uses the term blowjob grip. No. maybe you could edit that out.
No, I'm not editing that out. Fuck no. Are you kidding me? Choke somebody?
Oh yeah, well no, he calls it the Roadhouse.
The Roadhouse choke.
Right? I'm trying to pirate that instructional, not unsuccessfully so far, but no, I'm actually. It seems quite interesting. I've been trying to play around with it after seeing him put out the YouTube video and stuff. And I actually, I'm very close to buying it. So if some of my contacts don't come through, I'll have to give them some money. But yeah, obviously, I mean, a lot of the hand fighting was actually like hand fighting from top was inspired a lot by wrestling, but I also watched like obviously Rob's hand fighting instructional. It just seemed like a topic that not a lot of people discussed in the realm of jiu-jitsu, especially from the top position. Another instructional that I really like is Danaher's half guard passing and dynamic pins, the go further faster one.
In the gi.
I really think it's like, yeah, I thought this was one of the best instructionals he'd made, at least in my opinion. I thought it was super sick. Like, I don't hear many people talking about how awesome it is. So I probably we'll stick with that one. But I think obviously it's hard to attribute everything to an instructional, especially after this point of having watched instructional for I don't know how many years, but yeah.
What's your favorite and least favorite part about jiu-jitsu?
My favorite part?
The girls.
Probably. I would be in another sport. No. No.
It's the fellas, obviously.
Yeah. I answer first? Okay.
The homies.
The best thing are the haters. I love you. You are my biggest supporters. Please keep supporting me.
And do you have a lot of haters? What I hate. You seem like a liked guy.
Bro, trust me, there are a lot of people that don't like me. They don't know what
Maybe
I do.
Maybe it's not a lot relative to the people who follow you.
Oh, yeah, relative to the people that like me, it's not a lot, but it's definitely already more than Joseph has. And he's well known, right? Like maybe 8 times of my
people don't publicly hate me.
Yeah, don't publicly hate you. Yeah.
Actually, it depends.
But still, I think they will push me because I love WWE. And guys, you need to understand, every time you write a hate comment, the algo will help everybody to see this. And then the people that like me will find me, and then I have more people that like me. So thank you. Please continue. Thank you for your support. The thing that I hate the most about jiu-jitsu is the culture where it's not being open-minded and the culture where people think that they know everything. This is the best thing to do, not only in technique, but also in culture, also in how to talk, how to greet people, stuff like this. Open source is the way to go.
It's funny you mentioned WWE. I don't watch it anymore, but man, I loved WWF when I was a kid, the Attitude Era. Do you have a favorite wrestler? And Joseph, are you into this bullshit or no?
Of course, Mark Calloway. If you guys don't know who he is, he's the Undertaker and he's the greatest of all time. You can tell me whatever. If I could meet Mark Calloway one day, I would be the happiest man on earth.
Is the Hell in the Cell with Mick Foley the best match of all time?
It's up there, but the best one's against Shawn Michaels in WrestleMania. The first one.
See, I understand how great Undertaker is because he's like backstage. He was known as like, he's basically like the main guy. You know, he's like the leader back there. But like just his style, he was always just looking so gassed. He's just always so tired. He's got that slow style. Like for me, I always liked Kane more personally. I was always more of a Kane guy and I thought he did his moves better personally.
I think like the moves, if you only look at the move, maybe he did certain moves better, but the whole play in the match, the storytelling, this is where Taker excels and with keeping his character intact. And also, don't forget, this dude was already old when we both started watching wrestling. Like, he was already pretty old, right? And he still kept up, had millions of surgeries, and entertained us. So, love you, Taker.
Okay. We got to go here pretty quickly. What's the strangest thing that's ever happened to you guys in training or competition?
Oh, I need to think
about strangest.
This. First, I need to think about it, and then I need to think if I can tell it.
I don't know. I don't feel like anything too weird has happened to me. Like, the probably weirdest thing is seeing someone's balls when they weren't wearing underwear or something like this. That's not even that, like.
Okay, wait.
Okay.
I can tell something. It's after the training, but I think people will enjoy it. Should I? Yeah, I will.
What are you? We want to hear it, man. Come on.
Sorry.
Oh, if you want.
I we need to. Okay, so.
It's not even. That's just.
Bro, it will be funny. So, people, if you don't know this, he has a German passport. I'm a German, so we both have a German passport. So, one day after practice, we are in the shower of B team, okay? And we wait for the guys to get finished so we can shower. And then Joseph's like, or I don't know who started this, but one of us was like, I have a longer reach than you have. And I'm like, or the other one was, no, I have a longer reach. And then we are comparing reaches in underwear to Germans, and we were comparing it like this. Do it with me. Do it with me. Yeah, like this. And someone took a picture. I can't do the pose right now, but you guys can think what we did there. And they took a picture of us in underwear. Two Germans. Like, and the guy who took the pose, Liam, took the picture. A friend of us. Of course, also B-team member. No. Liam.
Alpang.
Liam Alpang. Isn't that Ethan's brother, Liam Krellison?
No, that's another Liam.
Different. This is a Swedish Liam.
Not a Jewish Liam.
So basically, not the Jewish Liam. So he basically shows us the picture. Oh, two ordinary Germans, nothing special in them. We're standing like,
Man, if you do that in Scotland, I think they can fucking arrest you. Can't, right? Isn't that like a hate crime?
I doubt it.
In Germany, right? You can't do that in Germany, can you?
We will definitely not measure our reach in Germany.
Yeah, fuck. I'm Canadian, so I deserve all the criticism in the world. But man, you guys got to get over that. It happened fucking 80 years ago. You know, let's put it under the. It's all water under the bridge at this point. Okay, man, I got to go teach a kids class pretty quickly. So I'll just wrap it up with one more question, guys. My favorite question of all: did we go to the moon?
I don't smoke enough weed to
I think so. Yes.
You think so?
I think you can test it. Can't you test it by?
It's not the curvature of the Earth. It's did we go to the moon?
Yeah, did we go to the moon? But they planted something in the moon, and then you can shoot the light laser, and the light comes back.
Really?
Yeah. You can shoot the light there, and the
that's
light
what
comes
they say.
Back,
yes.
And this is the proof. Yes.
I have no clue. What do you think?
I don't think so.
Really?
Well,
you don't think that they were on the moon at this time, or that they never
went to the moon as in probably landed shit on the moon? Are you saying you're thinking the moon landing is fake?
I don't think man can go to the moon personally. Have you seen the last time that they went to the moon and they blast off from the moon? There's footage on YouTube. No, you can watch it. It's pretty crazy. Yeah, maybe I'll leave it in the show notes in the bottom, because first of all, it's the fakest looking shit ever. But when it takes off, the camera pans up and zooms into this thing. I'm like, did they leave somebody behind on the fucking moon? How did it pan up? Did it happen from Houston or?
If you think about this emotion and without emotions, like they were at the war with Russia, okay, and they competed against each other. So let's say even if they didn't land at the moon, it helped them a lot. But I think because of the experiment where you can shoot it up and it comes back, I think everybody can do it. I think multiple people did it around the world to test it, also non-Americans. So they had to be on the moon at one certain time, but you don't have...
But you can put stuff on the moon, but doesn't mean man can be on the moon.
Oh, you mean that someone put it there?
Yeah, he's saying the moon landing. Like the people.
Yeah, but how can you put it in there if nobody lands there?
Okay, what about this? What about this? Live feed, 1969 from the moon, zero lag time in 1969. Is it possible?
Bro, I don't know.
You can't play fucking Call of Duty with somebody next door without there being lag time.
But don't forget, that's a interesting question. But the thing is, I think they put so much money into it, and it wouldn't make sense to put so much money again into it. So maybe we need to look at how much money they spend there also. Like, if you see that the amount was way higher, maybe you can say, okay, it's because of this. But if the amount is the same...
Maybe the money was just going to the Illuminati, and they just had to have a cover-up.
Oh, man. That's pretty true.
Wait,
did you have Eddie Bravo on the show?
I wish, man. Fuck, I would like to. I reached out to him. Let's talk the moon landing.
Yeah,
no, for sure.
I think you need to talk about this with him. I think he's more educated.
He's more educated.
We haven't talked. Let's say we haven't reached the point where we talk that much about conspiracy theories. We're still pretty like.
We're not smoking weed, so I think.
Also, no, our sense of humor or our intellect doesn't reach that capacity. We can only like just be like super retarded.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and that's what I'm good at. Anyways, guys, that was a fun conversation. And I really appreciate you guys coming on the show, especially with your busy schedule. And, you know, I'll definitely be watching ADCC. I think that's in September, right? That's
I think mid-August.
August? That's my fucking Super Bowl, dude. And I wish you all the best in the 77-kilogram division. It's going to be so awesome. And, yeah, man, it's a pleasure to talk to both you guys. Before I let you go, guys, if you want to support the show, check out the links in the bottom. Please like, share, subscribe, comment wherever you are. Joseph and Dima, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking conspiracy theories with me.
It was our pleasure.
Like this podcast, everyone.
Awesome. All right, guys. Remember, Everyday Jiu-Jitsu Podcast, everything you need to know about jiu-jitsu. See you later.